This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Breaking news on the programme. Work has stopped on the demolition of the Boyne Bridge in Belfast. I know what you're thinking. Why? And you might be thinking, really? Who cares? Well, I'll tell you why you might care, is because the Boyne Bridge is a story which touches on the history, the geography and the economy of Belfast, the biggest city here. What is happening around the Boyne Bridge could also have some implications for traffic in Belfast. And I know that affects tens of thousands of people. So, have a listen.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Breaking news this morning on the Boyne Bridge in South Belfast. We can reveal that work to demolish the bridge has stopped. And it's not clear when it's going to start again. As we know, work began at the end of November. Do you remember this? That was the sound, the very noisy sound of the bridge being demolished. The diggers came in, the workforce came out, and it was estimated it would take about 2 months, with a break for Christmas, to completely take down the old bridge. But now, if you walk past the building site, this is what you'll hear. Nothing. The sound of silence. We don't know exactly when work stopped. It could have been weeks ago, for all we know. Translink have not confirmed it has stopped. We'll come back to that. But the Nolan Show has seen two pieces of official paperwork from the Department for Infrastructure saying demolition of the Boyne Bridge has ceased. So what does that actually mean, though? Why is this important? Well, for a start, it throws into doubt the timeline for the completion of the nearby Grand Central Station. Also, as we know, an important road in the city centre, Durham Street, has been closed to allow the demolition to happen. Is that now going to be closed for longer than expected? And the big issue, what would that mean for traffic congestion in Belfast? And this is one for the taxi drivers and anyone dropping off or picking up at the new station. Is it going to put back the long-awaited drop-off zone outside Grand Central? Or is this all just a temporary blip? This is a complex project. Something like this was always going to happen. I think it cost £340 million, a very complex planning project. And nobody should be all that shocked that there's been a breach of one of the many, many planning conditions. But what is going on? Should Translink not have foreseen this? And as I say, could there be an impact on traffic in Belfast? Let's try to get some answers to some of those questions. First things first, why has work been stopped? Well, as I say, the reason is very simple at one level. The work is currently in breach, we're told, of a planning condition, quite a complicated one, but with somebody in the studio who can hopefully explain that. For those who like the detail, we're going to bring that to you too later in the programme. In summary, and thanks for staying with me, an investigation into planning concerns began last month. At the start of last month, we're told, and it was taken by the Department for Infrastructure, which is quite ironic in a way because they came up with the money to pay for the new station. They're kind of gamekeepers and poachers in all of this, metaphorically speaking. So they had a look at what Translink was doing in terms of the planners. And in a letter obtained by this programme, a Stormont lawyer confirms there has been an investigation since early in December over non-compliance with planning conditions. The letter was dated the 9th of January this year that we have seen. It was from Stormont's departmental solicitor's office, and it's there in black and white. It says demolition work has ceased. The Ulster Architectural Heritage Society has been banging on the door of the department about this. And this is one of those rare occasions when we can name one of our sources. John Anderson from the Heritage Society is with us. You got this letter. When you saw it there in black and white that demolition work had ceased. Were you surprised?
No, not at all, because the thing resulted, the letter resulted from a complaint made by us to the department via our solicitors. The matter actually isn't complicated. The planning condition is very simple.
Tell us.
It just says no work is to start until there's a viable traffic plan in place. Now, clearly on the ground, that's not the case. The simplest solution, you need to realise our focus is protecting built heritage, and this bridge is a very important piece of built heritage. It also fixes the problem because traffic can continue over the bridge and pedestrians can get direct access from Great Victoria Street to the new station by walking below the bridge without having to cross a road and probably being protected from the rain.
Let's deal with the matter in hand. Sadly for you, John Anderson, that ship has sailed. You've tried to get the bridge listed, you failed. You went to the courts, you tried to get the demolition stopped, you failed. You seem to have succeeded here, though, in a temporary halt. I mean, put away your own bias, if I can call it that, about what you want to happen next. Do you think work will start again quite soon and it'll be back to normal?
No.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, hold that thought. Let's bring in an expert, or another expert, I should say, to give you your place, John, in terms of heritage anyway. Professor Geraint Ellis is from the School of Natural and Built Environment at Queen's University. We need an expert, Geraint. What do you make of all of this?
Well, it looks like it's a bit of a mess, but as you say, it's a complex project. I wouldn't say it was inevitable, but then other things could have been foreseen, I think. And it seems to me that the heart of the planning problem, rather than the architectural heritage problem that John is talking about, is that TransLink have been very late in putting into place and agreeing the measures with Department of Infrastructure planners. And it seems that that process is still ongoing while they went ahead and got permission to close Durham Street with then all the consequences for congestion and so on. And the condition says, you know, that they must produce a transport mitigation measures and so on. And they have done a whole list of things. And it seems, well, I don't know what else they can do, given that the road transport network is saturated. Now, they could throw money at it, put new public transport measures in and so on. I don't know what they can do. But it hasn't been signed off, as far as I'm concerned. And one of the complications is that it's not just DFI planners and TransLink, but also DFI Transport are involved, who actually came up with the mitigation measures in conjunction with TransLink. So there's also a little battle within DFI itself, I think. So I think what's John's right in saying the condition is simple. What's complicated is the timing and the overlapping responsibilities within DFI, I think.
Geraint, what would you say to taxi drivers, traders on Sandy Row, to folk who want to be able to drop off friends or family at the station and are now worried that this whole demolition will now drag on and we could be talking next year before it's all finished?
Well, clearly DFI planners have to trade off: is it worth putting a halt to it and getting more measures in, or is it worth just letting them go on substandard measures and getting it over and done with? Now, you know, that depends on the inevitability of whether the bridge is coming down, which clearly John is against. But, you know, and that might then put some of the wider things of the project in doubt. I don't know about that. So that's the trade-off. So do the taxi drivers want to hold their nose and get through the construction, or would they rather it proceed with a much better set of transport mitigation in place, which might take quite a while to sort out? I mean, I don't know. DFI are the only people that can answer that.
And in terms of how unusual it is, I use that very crude, clumsy analogy of poacher and gamekeeper. So you have the Department for Infrastructure, who paid for this new station, who are the kind of governing body of TransLink. They give TransLink all their money. But at the same time, they're the watchdog here in terms of the planners. How unusual is that in a civilised society?
Yeah, that's pretty unusual, because you'd have thought there's got to be independence of decision making. And I don't know what measures have been made within DFI, whether the minister is involved in this or whether he's leaving it to the various sections of the civil service to sort out amongst themselves. But, you know, there is a problem right across the planning system and environmental decision making in Northern Ireland that we lack independent voices, because I think the politicians were a bit wary of having that. And clearly, if we had a good independent body to go to, this whole thing might be sorted out much quicker.
Geraint, help me here. I've got this letter, this leaked letter, though I've revealed my source. It talks about enforcement action. It talks about the department might have the option of enforcement action, but doesn't say what that might be. They're not going to take that sort of action. But what do they mean by enforcement action?
So whenever someone undertakes a development, it's expected that that's undertaken in line with planning permission.
Okay.
And clearly that's not a waterproof, watertight system. So sometimes people build without planning permission on purpose or in ignorance. And in this case, they've gone ahead while not aligning with planning conditions. And planning conditions are put into place to make that planning application viable, you know, and in the public interest. And when development goes ahead not to agreed plans, then enforcement action comes in. Now, this is quite a complicated area as well, because it's discretionary. So the planning authority doesn't have to take action, but they may take action if they think it's practical to do so.
Right.
So weighing
like what?
Up the,
like what?
The legal costs and so on.
What could they do?
Well, usually it's resolved by the planning authority contacting the developer saying, look, there's something wrong here, you need to put it right. Mm. So that's a warning letter, and there might be a bit of negotiation.
Okay.
If that doesn't go well, there are legal powers that the planning authority can resort to, which go to the courts, and there's something called an enforcement notice. And then the developer is legally obliged to follow that. And if that doesn't happen, they can issue injunctions, fines, and so on.
And I think we would agree it would be bizarre if the Department for Infrastructure was taking TransLink to court.
It is. But yeah. bear with me on this. There's another complication. Is that the department doesn't really have enforcement powers or only reserve. So they have to persuade Belfast City Council to get involved and for them to take the enforcement action. And if the city doesn't take enforcement action, only then can the Department of Infrastructure get involved. So we have TransLink, we have DFI Transport Branch, we have DFI Planners, and we have the City Council all involved in this murky mess.
Well, we've got a Belfast City Councillor on the line. We're going to come to him at the moment. We've also just got a statement from the DFI. I want to read out what TransLink said to us around 8 o'clock this morning. We did ask them at around lunchtime yesterday. We got the statement more than 12 hours later. But anyway, John Anderson, a quick word from you on what Geraint has just said.
Well, for a start, there's a few misconceptions here. TransLink have missold the need to demolish the bridge right from day one. There was no need to demolish the bridge. The bridge has got nothing to do with the station and the building of the station and the operation of the station. In fact, retaining the bridge would have solved all of these problems at a stroke. Now, secondly, in terms of enforcement, in the Built Heritage, we see on a regular basis this so-called enforcement system. And before this came in 2015, and there were split powers handed to the councils, we told them what would happen. What we have now is a circular, not me, mate system. So there actually is no enforcement.
Well, that's the big picture. Let's get back to the matter at hand. That TransLink statement, which, as I say, came in at around 8 o'clock this morning, enabling work to facilitate the dismantlement of the bridge continues, ensuring key elements of the bridge are repurposed in the new civic space, Saltwater Square. We are working through the planned phases of work while we collaborate closely with relevant stakeholders to ensure alignment with the complex planning processes. Work to dismantle the bridge will be carried out as quickly as possible. The DFI confirmed there was a meeting actually yesterday between the Minister John O'Dowd and Edwin Putz MLA, Speaker of the Stormont Assembly, but of course a South Belfast MLA. That's the hat he was wearing. They met yesterday, apparently, and they talked about the Boyne Bridge. Be good to get Edwin Putz on if we can. Okay, what did the DFI say? They say officials have investigated the works which began on the Boyne Bridge last year. So confirming what we said at the top of the show. there was an investigation. And the chief planners got involved. The chief planner wrote to TransLink advising of the investigation. DFI officials will continue to process applications to discharge conditions relating to Grand Central Station and are engaging with TransLink to discuss the steps which are necessary in order to comply, future tense, with the relevant planning conditions. Nobody's saying it out loud, but nobody is denying that work has now ceased. And we're told Belfast City Council may have a stake in all of this. Carr White, SDLP councillor. Now, I need to be clear here. If you're on the planning committee at City Hall, you might have a conflict of interest here. Can you talk to us?
I can talk about the general traffic chaos that has engulfed the area around Grand Central Station, Mark. And I was there one day with you, actually, when you were working for Newsline, and we saw a red light that was paused red yes. for, I think, 15 minutes. So I think it's staggering that DFI planning, and they're discharging their responsibility to monitor the conditions of a planning application. And this is all very jargony. You know, a planning application, you get approval if you want to build an extension to your house or whatever it is, but there's also some conditions. So a condition might be don't build a house too high, don't put a window here. On big applications, those conditions are much more complex. And a traffic management plan is a common condition for any major construction project. And those are completed by yeah. consultants or the applicant themselves, and they're approved by the planning authority, which in this case would have been DFI, albeit they would have had to work with DFI Roads. So DFI planners are doing their job if they've identified a problem with the traffic management plan or the absence of a traffic management plan. But it didn't take Einstein to work out that there wasn't a traffic management plan or an adequate one around Grand Central in September and October. Or October, November, when it closed, because it was absolute traffic chaos.
I think the key word there, Carl, was adequate. Because yeah. you're right, there was a plan. I think John Anderson used the word valid. It's quite subjective. And however bad the traffic was in Belfast and has been in recent months, you know, compared to an awful lot of other European cities, you know, it was maybe par for the course. And you could argue,
No, that's not true. Belfast has among some of the most congested streets as it is in the UK and in Europe. So this line, that, and I've heard that sort of being, you know, peddled by certain groups or agencies or people involved. No, that's not a normal level of traffic construction. There are major traffic, major infrastructure projects taking place in Dublin, for example, London. You don't see chronic traffic disruption like we saw in the run up to Christmas, where the whole city is essentially in gridlock. So there was a problem there with DFI Roads. There's been a problem here with the traffic management plan at Grand Central. But the question is, what's going to happen now?
Yeah, well, that's what I wondered. What are you hearing, Carl? Are you hearing this? You know, this will be sorted out within days and weeks.
No, I was there. I was there on Sunday actually, and I noticed that the bridge, it was a sort of giant colossus sitting in the middle of a parking. You know, what essentially looks like sort of a large bus park. I thought, that's strange. It doesn't look like there's any activity around there. I think there'll need to be the DFI will need to be satisfied there's an adequate traffic management plan in place. Work needs to commence, but TransLink need to answer, well, why wasn't this plan? Why did the work begin without the plan? They did say this work will be completed by January. Now we're towards the end of January. When will it be completed? Are TransLink now going to be out additional costs? Because they will have hired a contractor to do this work, and the contractor, it's not the contractor's fault that there was no proper traffic management plan or that DFI have issued this letter. And then there is the question of enforcement. And your other contributor is correct. The council do an enforcement role, but so do DFI. So DFI is the overall planning authority in Northern Ireland. They can actually get involved in any planning application they want to through like a call-in process. So, you know, whether it goes down that road or not, I don't know. But the impetus is to get this completed. You know, it's interesting you're saying that John O'Dowd met with Edwin Poots. Well, has John O'Dowd met with the chief executive of TransLink and his own officials to sort this out? And I have a lot of sympathy with the residents of Sandy Row or the traders of Sandy Row. You covered that issue last week very well. And, you know, they're now going to be scratching their heads thinking, okay, well, we thought this would be a year. Now, the clock's been put on hold. It could be a year and 6 months. It could be 2 years. were essentially a main thoroughfare. The government has closed it and sort of washed their hands of it and said, well, you know, tough luck.
Speaking of Sandy Row, Ben Allen is on the line, one of the traders there. Ben, have you been following all of this?
Yes, Mark, yes. I've been listening very carefully. This is absolutely amazing. It just gets worse by the day. You know, what on earth? A project that's now going to hit 400 million, no doubt. And as the local traders here, we haven't even had a letter to say that this road's being closed. Now, are we talking years? Is there going to be a movie about this in 10 years' time? Is that bad? What on earth? How can a project this big be so badly prepared for? It's unbelievable.
And have you noticed, or is the word on the street, or has the word been on the street for a couple of days or a couple of weeks now, that the banging has stopped and the work has stopped? Could you have told us this last week, for instance?
Well, we knew the work stopped well before Christmas. You know, we see it every day. You know, this is where we work.
Before so Christmas?
The work stopped. Yes, yes. Nothing's happened there for quite some time now.
Well, that's interesting. Back to Carl White's point that, you know, if you have hired a construction company or a demolition gang to come in and do some work, the clock is ticking, the meter is still running when you're saying to them, we know we've hired you for this period of time, but we don't need you or we can't use you. So you could be right, Carl White, there could be extra costs if Ben is right and the work actually stopped before Christmas.
Yeah, I think the question, there is a serious question here. You know, a Translink bus driver knows the bus route that he's driving on. A Translink train driver knows the train route that he's taking. So here he was in charge of doing the traffic management plan. There's a very clear process set out, Mark, about how you do this plan, who approves it. So there needs to be clarity about where it's gone wrong. It's hit the buffers here, and now DFI planners have got involved. All they're doing is their job. It's in the condition of their planning application. That this is what you have to do, so could you please go and do it? And they haven't done it. And what are the implications in terms of delays on the project? You know, further wait for Sandy Road traders to get that street up and running again, and also then the cost potentially to Translink.
John Anderson, in the nicest possible way, is this all your fault? Do you think if you hadn't contacted the department last year that anything would have stopped?
No, hold on a minute, Mark. That's not fair. This is Translink's fault. Translink missold the need to get rid of the bridge from day one. They missold it to the council. They missold it to DFI. They missold it to the public because they said it was essential to the design and operation of the new station, which is nonsense. There was no need to touch the bridge other than reinstating where the trains were removed from below it so that pedestrians could walk directly to the station. And this, you know, for Carl, this is in Belfast City Council's city centre strategic plan. Direct access from Great Victoria Street to the station for pedestrians and the promotion of retail on that path. Now, what they have actually done is put big retail into the station, which is taking away trade from the city centre.
Well, you need, like, every train station, bus station needs a coffee shop. They've got, what, two coffee shops, a supermarket and a bar. Like, every station, modern station needs that.
And what has it done to the Northern Mall, to the traders in the Northern Mall?
Well, some of them are still there. I just need to come back to you on Translink and I know a lot of people have worked very hard to build this station and they're at it night and day, including at the moment. And it would be good if somebody senior in Translink could come on and defend themselves. But they would certainly dispute, John, that they misled anyone. And this isn't going to work on radio, but you and I have had that discussion on the Point Bridge before it was dismantled or demolished. And I hear your point, which is you could have still had this new saltwater square. You still could have had this new civic space. You still could have had a drop-off zone outside the new station with the bridge there as a feature.
Exactly.
Okay.
But what you couldn't have had is speculative property development.
Well,
and that is what this is about.
But I mean, you've got to be able to sort of wash your own face at the end of all of this.
Aye, but hold on a minute.
Mark, this has been a feature of this debate where this sort of, you know, negativity and, oh, it's about property developers.
No, this is not negativity.
No, the city needed a new public transport hub. A female relative of mine was saying the other day, how much safer she feels coming in the Grand Central at night compared to Glengall Street, where you basically were just turfed out on the middle of a street in the middle of the city in the middle of the late at night. So, you know, Grand Central is a good thing. It's more than just teething difficulties. These have been very serious problems that have had a negative impact on the city. Today's news is not good, but it was obvious to anybody who spent more than 1 minute around that area once that station opened that there wasn't a proper traffic management plan. Now there needs to be, and DFI and Transit need to get their heads together and this issue needs solved as quickly as possible.
And Belfast City Council need to get their head round the city's built heritage, which is a key. This is nothing to do with nostalgia. This is to do with the profit for the city, for the traders, for the future. Look around the world and city administrations value their built heritage. Belfast City Council does not.
As I said at the top of this programme, Carr, hold that thought. As we've seen, and it's played out, this is more than a bridge. It is about history, it is about geography, it is about the economy. Your calls are coming in. We're going to talk to a couple of taxi drivers. Back to the Boyne Bridge. We want to talk about the big picture as well as some of the granular detail. First of all, the big picture is, anecdotally, it does seem as if traffic has returned to some sort of normality. So maybe TransLink deserve a bit of credit for that. And also, we have been digging into the detail and it's not exactly clear what has been going on behind the scenes. That's why it'd be really useful just to have a very open, frank conversation with someone senior from TransLink today or tomorrow. Tell us what's happening. We found out that just at the end of last year, December the 16th, the Department for Infrastructure actually gave the green light to TransLink to continue work on the bridge after a revised plan to mitigate traffic congestion was submitted to the planning department. The next day, Stephen spoke to the DUP MLA for South Belfast, Edwin Putz.
Essentially, what we have here is a plan that has come in after the work had started. So to all intents and purposes, it would appear this plan was submitted beyond the time whenever the bridge was closed. But the second aspect of it is we now have this letter from DFI saying that the plan is good and the plan stands up to scrutiny and all of that there. So that's their desktop exercise. But the reality is something different. So the roads are so congested now that the public transport is delayed. Buses, people are telling me that they're waiting for half an hour on buses and they're not coming. The police are indicating that they can't get the calls. Carers are saying that they can't get to their calls in time. People are saying that they can't get to their hospital appointments in time. And all of these things are happening, let alone the damage that is being done to businesses. So businesses in Sandy Row in particular are really, really badly affected. But right across Belfast, businesses are being affected because people are not able to get into the city and do their business. So we'll have this robust plan. But what I would say about that is in the real world, people are saying the emperor has no clothes in this one, because the plan isn't with the paper it's written on whenever we actually see the reality. And for a letter to come out last week saying, well, we have a plan that this won't cause congestion, when everybody can feel that congestion that is existing, it's just ludicrous beyond belief.
So is it just subjective how robust that plan is or isn't? Professor Geraint Ellis from the School of Natural and Built Environment at Queen's is still with us. Am I right or wrong, Geraint?
Again, it is subjective, and the people that make a call on it is DFI, transport planners. And the actual condition that says that the impact will not adversely affect the road network. Now, clearly, that's not an absolute because, you know, if congestion just grows a little bit more, you know, is that an adverse impact or not? So you've got to try and weigh up the benefits of what the scheme is delivering and the short-term hit with any effects that will put, or the cost of providing other measures, which I don't know. And the plan does provide quite a range of things: park and ride, enhanced bus services, information sessions, pedestrian priorities, bus lane, new bus lanes, removal of some parking. But that doesn't, in practice, that doesn't seem to have made much impact. And I think the the core issue here is just the level of car dependency across, which is a long-term yes. issue that it just can't take anymore. And DfI, of course, is responsible for that as well.
Mm. Very interesting what Carr White was saying there, though, that in terms of public transport, Carr, your point that females in the city feel a bit safer at Grand Central, and that will be a big boost potentially in the years ahead for public transport, Carr.
Yeah, it was just a family member of mine said the other day, we were discussing this very issue, and she said, you know, coming in there at night time, it's a completely different experience than it was coming into Glengall Street, where essentially you arrive at a dark street, side street in the middle of the night or late evening when it's dark and you're out on your own. It was always hard to get to. Now, setting aside the issues with drop-off and pick-up at the moment at Grand Central, but we can't, you know, there is no, Grand Central is a phenomenal, as you pointed that out, Mark, it's a phenomenal transport hub. I think it's the biggest train bus station being built in the UK or Ireland in the last decade or something like that. And when you're in it, you understand why it's so important. And there's clearly been things that have been mishandled, and this is another example. And, you know, the heritage point as well. Not getting into whether the bridge should have been demolished or not, the issue wasn't handled well, and people were very upset and very annoyed about it.
I want to come in on the drop-off, because you've reminded me that Pat, the taxi driver, has just phoned in, that the whole drop-off issue. Pat, I suppose your big fear is you're told this drop-off area should be there by the end of this year. There's maybe a question mark over that now.
No, Mark. Originally at the start there, the first couple of days whenever Stephen was covering it, they said it would be finished at the end of the year. They just didn't say what year. That's what I touched on. But I want to go back to what Carr's talking about there. One of his relatives coming into Central Station or Grand Central Station feels a lot safer because it's different than getting dropped off in Glengall Street. I find that absurd, because if you get dropped off in Grand Central Station, you have to make your way to Glengall Street to get a taxi or to get a pickup or to get through into Great Victoria Street. So you're walking straight back through the same place. The bottom line is they haven't provided anywhere for the public to be dropped off or to be picked up, for disabled folk to be dropped off or picked up or make their way into the station. There's nothing. And I thought myself that whenever John Anderson's organisation were going for the injunction, for the judicial review, that they stuck diggers in and started on the Boyne Bridge straight away. Whenever the judge stood out of court, they stopped, because Ben Allen brought that up before Christmas, that there had been no work carried out on the Boyne Bridge. It was like 2 days remedial work, and then they all disappeared.
John Anderson's nodding here, John.
The taxi point is very relevant as well. The bus yard is sitting there now, redundant, being used for parking for staff or whoever. The bus yard, in conjunction with passengers walking under the bridge to the station, would have been a taxi circle. And again, completely safe, completely suitable for disablement. And the whole point of this is, as I say, our focus is built heritage, but the whole point of this is the problem was created by TransLink, where the solution was in place without doing anything.
They felt they had a better solution.
But no, they didn't have a solution.
Okay. We need them on the programme. Chris Conway, you've been on before. Come on. Give us a call today or tomorrow. Get your press office to sort that out. We have an hour and a half tomorrow as well. We're going to keep going today. Back to you, Pat. The point I made anecdotally, it seems to be slightly better on the roads around Belfast City Centre. Are you going to tell me I've got it? I'm talking nonsense here.
You're talking nonsense here. Mark, Great Victoria Street, no matter whenever you go into it, see that left turn that you can't get up the Grosvenor? It's causing chaos. Then you go down to Chester Street, the traffic's right down to Victoria Street, and it's just a knock-on effect, because people who are going to go up Great Victoria Street either have to go straight on down into Castle Street or into Durham Street and come round the other way. And the face first, if you're trying to get to the Grosvenor, you have to go down round City Hall and up Hard Street, so that's causing congestion. Okay. There's no grown-up thinking here, like.
Pat, surely it's a bit better. Surely Tuesdays are a bit better. Yesterday was a bit better than Tuesdays before Christmas.
Yeah, but the Tuesday before last week was absolute nightmare.
Okay, gotcha. Let's bring in Sammy. Sammy, you want to talk about the Boyne Bridge too. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Mark, I'm a retired civil engineer, and I'm embarrassed by my profession. Because I'll tell you something, and this is fact, and I'll prove it if you want me to. There's been 30 professional engineers working on this project for the last 30 years, and my hat off to John Anderson. He knows more than any of them put together. You make it a taxi rank, you keep the Boyne Bridge, and you have pedestrians getting into the taxis underneath the bridge, and you retain the connectivity instead of putting a pedestrian crossing. And people saying that it's wonderful and safe. When you get out of the lovely palace, the £340 million, you have to walk into Belfast. The glider doesn't even stop. You know, I guarantee you, there's 30 professionals have been working on this for 30 years, and they've made a mess. I built Bangor Railway Station, Mark.
You built Bangor Railway Station?
Single-handedly. there was boys with me. And we had to design and build a railway station and a bus station to cope with 20,000 passengers a day, every day, to make sure that the railway station stayed in the middle of the town.
Yeah, okay.
We've got a £340 million white elephant. And the cost will hit half a billion. They will, because they just haven't thought it through. And they should admit they're wrong, keep the Boyne Bridge, what John Anderson says, turn it into a taxi rank, make it pleasant for pedestrians to walk through, admit they're wrong, and get on with it, and get it fixed before the summer.
I don't have them in front of me, Sammy, but I can tell you I've seen some stats from Translink since it opened, 4 or 5 months ago, the new Belfast Grand Central Station. And the stats would suggest it's not a white elephant, quite the opposite. I think train and bus numbers are up. But Sammy makes the point, and I want to put this to John Anderson, keep the bridge. The last time I looked, John, not maybe most of the bridge, but a lot of the bridge is gone. The bridge is basically gone in all but name, or not?
No. The on and off ramps are largely complete. What Translink did, and one might speculate that they did it to try and do so much damage that the thing would become unviable. What they did was they removed the concrete from the steelwork. Now, that, as far as I can gather, has been done before in a previous refurbishment of the bridge. So it can be done again. There are two aspects to the heritage.
Sorry, just help our listeners here so that they can visualise this. So a lot of the concrete, maybe the wall on the top of the bridge is gone, but that steel structure that you want to preserve is still there.
Well, it's iron, and what you describe as the wall, the parapet of the bridge, is cast iron riveted panels. They're all still there.
Okay.
What they did was they stripped effectively the cement, the decorative Art Deco cement, off the inside of those panels. So the main structure of the bridge, the Harland Wolff structure, that was done in benefit to Harland and Wolff in the teeth of the Depression in the 30s, when there was no work about. This was done to keep skilled people in work. And it is really important to Belfast history. You come in from wherever, you come into the station, and you walk in below this magnificent riveted steelwork, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of rivets put in by two men and a boy, every single rivet. Now, that is Belfast history. And Belfast City Council need to catch themselves on. They appear to think that this proposed Belfast Stories, you can have a pay-per-view AI digital Belfast.
John.
No,
some people may agree with you, but that ship has sailed, to use another infrastructure analogy.
Which ship is this? It's not a Harland Wolff ship.
Well,
anyway.
I'm looking at this letter. I don't want to bore listeners with the detail, but I mean, you mentioned again about listing the bridge whenever you wrote to DFI, and they said, you know, nothing to do with us. Go to the Department for Communities.
We never asked DFI to list the bridge.
Okay.
We wouldn't do that.
Okay. Hold that thought. Geraint, are you still with us?
An interesting conversation. And I think getting back to the letter that you discussed,
yes.
I think there's a key question is why Translink had the confidence to proceed and clearly putting themselves at risk from all this public scrutiny and so on and potential. Why did they have confidence proceed when all of this wasn't signed off. And I would suggest, speculatively, first of all, because there's a very relaxed culture of enforcement in Northern Ireland, so people get away with things, or there's been an informal conversation within DFI. And what often happens with the planning system, there's cracks everywhere, and whenever just a little bit of scrutiny is put on it, like the Architectural Heritage Society has done in this, those cracks appear. So there's very major structural issues to do with the planning system that when a light is shined, they come up glaring. And there's a long, long history of this from the Audit Commission, the Public Accounts Commission, and so on. So there's a culture there of relaxed enforcement. And I think that's part of the context as well.
I'm mixing my metaphors here, but do you think the ship has sailed in terms of the Boyne Bridge being retained?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard what John has said then, and he's an expert on this. So in some ways, you know, I've heard his view, and there's probably others as well. So I'm not an expert on the architectural heritage or the construction of it. So I simply don't know on that one.
Hmm. You can get a good view of it on Glengall Street if anybody is anywhere near there. You can also bump into Pat the taxi driver as well if you're there. You can see through the railings of the old Glengall Street bus station. You can see, and actually if you're in the Grand Central Station, if you look out on the forecourt there where the buses are, you can get a good look at the bridge.
And you can see how close it is.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And to come back to the taxis briefly, it probably would be possible to also give the taxis a straight exit onto the Westlink on the route that the buses take out of the station as an added bonus.
Oh my goodness, they'd love that. They would love that. Okay, who else wants to talk about this? Janet!
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I say. That wee man from Bangor who helped with the Bilton Bangor station had it absolutely spot on. He was absolutely right. It is a white elephant. Waste of money. I've used it once and I would never use it again. I used to go to the old station, walk through the front door, down the mall, turn left, up my train. Last time I went to use it, an absolute nightmare to get to the actual train station. Got there, big queue at the ticket machine. Nobody knew how to use them. I was running short of time. I thought, well, if this doesn't move quickly, I'm not going to get my train. There was nobody there to show the people. So, eventually got my ticket, and then you have to put it through the barrier. Got to the train in the nick of time. I will never use that new station ever again. After that, I went up to Botanic Avenue station. I was in Great Victoria one day, and I needed to get a train. I took the bus up to Botanic and got the bus at Botanic station.
Janet, every person, every new organisation, every new building has teething problems. What about a second chance for Grand Central?
No chance. Absolutely.
Oh, come on. None. Come on.
Absolutely none. Absolutely. Do you realise what you have to go through to walk to the station? Through barriers, bumps, lumps?
Ah, but we're back to the Boyne Bridge. When they get rid of the Boyne Bridge, it's all going to be smooth.
Or if they keep the Boyne Bridge, it'll all going to be smooth.
Who let that man into the studio? He's now interrupting me. This never happens to Stephen. Janet, back to you.
I think you're a wee bit biased, Mark, if you don't mind me saying, and I've noticed that all morning, that you're a wee bit biased in favour of the station and against the people who are not for it.
Janet,
if you don't mind me saying so.
No, I thank you for calling me out on that. I think in my role, because TransLink haven't come on, the Minister hasn't come on, the road service hasn't come on, I have to be devil's advocate a bit. I don't like using that expression, but you know, I have to put the other side of the argument. That's why it's called the Nolan Show. It's a show, it's a discussion. I think those points have to be made because anecdotally, especially over Christmas, whenever I met, you know, people who hadn't seen the station before, who are maybe home for Christmas. You know, I'm that generation where a lot of them now live in Scotland or England or the States. I have a daughter in Dubai. You know, anecdotally, I heard a lot of positive things said about the new station. That's all I'm saying, Janet.
Well, I'm of a different opinion and I'm determined. I will never use it again. I will use Botanic.
Janet, what about you and I going back someday? If I went with you?
No, I never darkened the doors of that place again. It was just awful. And it's a total waste of millions of pounds. Absolute total waste.
You're turning me down?
Turning you down, absolutely.
I'll buy the coffee. That's my final offer.
I will not darken the doors of that news station ever again. I'll use Botanic.
Final offer, a coffee and a bun.
No, that will not do it. No, no, I'm sorry. That's
well,
not going to happen.
If you change your mind, get in touch. Janet, listen, we appreciate you calling. You're entitled to your opinion. Fred, what do you say?
Well, I have to say thank you for having me to get the decision. As yet, because I use it for going to hospital appointments at the hospital. But what I look or think is someone said there's been another bit of a traffic cock-up made in our local town of Bonbridge here. Someone took a decision, I'm sure it has been in the press, but anyhow, we'll get back to that in a minute. No, I think when these few people now plan these things on a computer screen, and what looks well on a computer screen sometimes is not practical. And I think that's where a lot of these things happen. Excuse me, but in Bambridge, they changed the traffic flow, which was tried 10 years ago, and now they're trying it again.
Right.
And it's making a whole cock up in the middle of the town. But to try and get around this, someone about 3 weeks after it was brought into service had a picture of an artist's impression was put in to show the way it worked.
Mm.
But they didn't include the buildings or the parapet of the bridge.
Right. Right.
So you can't actually see, and it's the traffic going south through Bonbridge, through the centre of the town, has to stop on a very steep incline before they cross over the road, which they used to have the right of way.
Fred.
Now the traffic on the more level way, they have the right of way.
Fred, we may talk about that on another day. The Boyne Bridge, what do you think should happen?
The Boyne Bridge, a few weeks ago, there's one of the programmes, I think, was the one after 12 o'clock. And
talk
about
with William.
Our heritage with William.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it is a part of our heritage. It was doing a good job. But now it's been, as I said at the time, and they didn't put me on with it, you must remember that all this traffic, this new increased rail traffic to Dublin is now causing great problems in Lurgan.
Right. Fred, I take your point, more trains, but, you know, Fred, some will say, and I'll let you go, some will say, you know, we sometimes just can't have nice things here, that we see the downside of something. So, yeah, Lurgan's a bit busier. I'm sure there's a lot more traffic near that level crossing right in the heart of Lurgan town centre. But then, you know what? You get more trains, you get more access to Dublin, and we know a lot of money's been put into that service. But, Fred, like Brenda, you're entitled to your point. Jim in Belfast, help me here. Bring me some sunshine.
Fred Nutt, I'm sorry to say, my point relates to two things. The glider, which doesn't relate to the central station at all. There's no link, it's not a hub. So in someone analysing how people move around the city, like anything else, you should be able to come on a plane, get in an airport, get on a train, get to the city centre, and that's the job done. However, the glider doesn't link to anything. It's east or south or east to west. That's fine, but it doesn't go through Central Station. Back to my airports thing, which is linked to the rail. Why do we not have rail stations that are adjacent to the airports? Sydenham. Mm-hmm. I got a train from Central Station down. It was pouring. Carried my bags over the footbridge. Walked along the dual carriageway and got into the airport. And then, of course, the other one is Aldergrove. Yes, we go to Aldergrove and we pay 50 quid on the taxi to get up there. And if you happen to be on a delayed flight, and this is fact, and you're coming out of Belfast, the taxi drivers can rub their hands and charge what they want.
Not all of them.
I'm not generalising. I'm saying some drivers are opportunists.
Well, fair enough. I want to get back to the Boyne Bridge. Geraint, people are making good points that we're not generally joined up in terms of our transport infrastructure here. You know, there's no train station at the international airport. It is a bit of a jaunt to Sydenham Station from Belfast City. The glider stops, I think, is it outside Inst, which is probably a good 5 or 10 minute walk from Grand Central. Is that a money issue or a bad management issue?
Well, it could be all sorts of things. I think it is a resourcing issue. And I don't think, you know, on top of spending priorities, public transport has been an issue. But we have a very major problem with transport, huge car dependency that we've known for, I don't know, 20 years. And the government has tried to turn this round and it still hasn't done so. all sorts of things. I think strong political leadership, when you see that taken in cities, actually you can quite quickly, within a couple of years, turn that round. The cycling network hasn't been implemented. Constant frustration about the airports and so on. And that coordinated with good planning as well. So we're continuing to give planning permission to things that generate, you know, car activity within the city and in the countryside.
Geraint, thank you. I'm going to let you go. Thanks for your time this morning. You're a busy man. We appreciate it. I'm going to give John Anderson the last word in a moment. I may regret that for the rest of my life because I'll not have a right of reply. Quick word from Robert before the 10 o'clock news. You go first, Robert.
Good morning. Quick answers. Train to Sydenham or Belfast City is nonsense. A much better bus service. Trains at some stages are only every hour. The bus is every 15 minutes. Secondly, bus to Aldergrove is the answer. It's every 15 minutes, and there isn't enough passengers to make it a real sustainable. They would need 10 million passengers, which not all three airports combined don't have 10 million passengers. But on the subject of Mr. White about the access to Grand Central, the old access from Great Victoria Street and Glengall Street was excellent. You walked out of a covered area which was warm, lighted, had food facilities. You could buy a newspaper. You got out on Great Victoria Street. You were in an area of high footfall. You were much safer than coming through the alleyway which they've built with chipboard or whatever it is. And getting you then, and also no taxis, of course. There were taxis always in Glengall Street.
Yeah, still are.
Yes, but they're not at GC. They're not at GC, which is the issue. Okay. And also, by the way, my experience of TransLink, I've had to put in FOI requests.
Okay, Robert, that's a whole other issue. John Anderson, I'm going to give you the last word. You've got 30 seconds. I want you to speak from your head, not your heart. Do you think you will ever save the Boyne Bridge?
Well, that's our object, and we will take every measure available to us. We will go to audit on built heritage protection generally, because this is actually a test case. We will go to the various ombudsmen, and if an opportunity for more legal action presents itself, we will do that. But we are not the dog in the manger here.
Okay.
TransLink is the dog in the manger because the bridge should have stayed in the first place.
John Anderson, thank you. And that offer is there to TransLink to come onto the programme and defend themselves. And the offer is still there to Brenda. Let's go together to the Grand Central Station and have a cup of tea together. Right, let's pick up on one of the stories we heard there in the 10 o'clock news. Gerry Adams, back in the news. He's in line, apparently, to get a payout from the taxpayer. So why? Our crime and justice correspondent Julian O'Neill can explain. Morning, Julian.
Morning, Mark.
Tell us more.
Well, there's quite a complicated backstory here, and I don't want to have your listeners switching stations, Mark, but essentially, a 2020 UK Supreme Court judgment paved the way for Mr. Adams to receive damages after it quashed his convictions over two attempted prison breakouts while he was interned without trial in the 1970s. That opened the door for Mr. Adams to begin a process of seeking damages, but the door was slammed shut by the 2023 Legacy Act, because during that Act's passage through Parliament, the House of Lords inserted an amendment clause which essentially said that Mr. Adams and up to 400 others who may have also been held unlawfully could not seek compensation. Now, Labour's intention to repeal the Legacy Act will mean that that part of the legislation falls. So the issue of Gerry Adams possibly getting compensation could be back on the table.
Do we have any idea, Julian, how much he could be in line for?
There were several twists and turns in the courts on this issue, Mark, between 2020 and 2023. And during that process, I'm not aware of it ever being said publicly how much Gerry Adams was seeking. Now, I stand to be corrected on that, but I'm not sure a figure was ever put into the public domain. I think the bigger issue here clearly is the fact that it's not just Gerry Adams who may be eligible for compensation. The technicality here was that the interim custody order, which put Mr. Adams into internment, was deemed to have been unlawful because it was not considered personally by the then Secretary of State, Willie Whitelaw. Now, this administrative error, if I could call it that, also perhaps involved as many as 400 others who were interned. So if you think about not one compensation case, but potentially 400, then I think you're into many millions.
Are we talking 400 Republicans here?
I don't think so, Mark. I'm not 100% sure. That. I mean, clearly, internment was heavily skewed towards Republicans. Yeah. But I have in my mind also perhaps litigation in this respect, of non-Republicans.
And in terms of Gerry Adams himself, any reaction? He's what now, 76? He has taken a backseat in recent years, though he does do a weekly podcast where he comments on current events. Maybe we need to wait until the next episode of that. Nothing from him yet?
Nothing from him yet. I mean, I would imagine, I can't see any reason why Gerry Adams and his lawyers will not be watching this closely and waiting to see when this clause falls by the wayside. It's currently in parliamentary committee. I would expect that he will pursue compensation, and I say that on the basis that he began this process after the UK Supreme Court ruled in his favour in 2020. And in fact, when the Department of Justice turned him down for compensation, he successfully challenged that in court. But that was all superseded by this clause in the Legacy Act. So given that Mr. Adams started down this road after 2020 and the Legacy Act shut the door, I can't see why he wouldn't be in a position to restart that claim for compensation once this part of the Act goes. As I say, it's currently before Parliament. I heard Lord Keane on Good Morning Ulster essentially saying it looks to him like it's a done deal in terms of Parliament. But it is possible that Parliament could reject Labour's attempt through a remedial order to make this change. We'll have to wait and see. But Lord Keane appeared to be arguing that the better chance to have this remain on the statute books was to take a legal challenge. But he pointed out that Labour dropped the legal challenge this when it assumed power.
Just finally, Julian, on the politics, I know that's not your beat as such, your crime and justice, but it is turning into a bit of a ding-dong at Westminster here between Labour and the Conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think where the focus is at the moment on legacy is, you know, the pace at which Labour is going to dismantle the Legacy Act. However, it is taking a lot of heat from certain sections politically and from victims groups over its intention to stick with the Independent Commission for Reconciliation and Information Recovery. That's the legacy body. So people point out that for all Labour's talk of repealing the Legacy Act, it is keeping the last government central body to deal with legacy cases going forward.
Julian O'Neill, thank you as always. Have a good day. It's Wednesday. Are you bored with 2025 already? Are you thinking about a winter break? Lucky you if you can afford it. And if you go to the airport, are you one of those people that even though it's 8 o'clock in the morning, you like a little drink? Well, there is this ongoing proposal from Ryanair to try and limit the number of drinks that we have at airports, alcoholic drinks, that is, at any time of the day. Two, they reckon, is about fair. Three would be one too many. But is that fair? Let's talk to a couple of commentators. I don't know how much they drink at airports or anywhere else. Maybe we'll ask them. Lembit Opick and Emma Wolfe. Good morning.
Morning to you.
Emma, do you mind talking about your drinking habits in front of the Radio Ulster public?
More than happy to. I was actually working it out this morning. I haven't had a drink for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I love a drink, but I had a baby and then life is just too busy. I haven't had a drink and I don't really miss it. But as for airports, why are we even allowing people to drink alcohol in airports? In what planet is it safe for people to be getting on flights? And you see them sometimes. You see them in the mornings, early mornings, in the pubs and in the bars at airports. You know, hen parties, stag do's, getting on flights, which is a confined space. It's absolutely crazy. I think the Ryanair proposal is a really good idea, but actually, I would just say no alcohol. No alcohol in airports and on flights.
Lambert, tell us about your drinking habits, if you don't mind.
I tend to travel more on business, and I'm often on really early flights, like 7 or 8 in the morning, or already late. So it doesn't really lend itself to drinking for me, but I totally disagree with what we've just heard. In my view, and it's a view which many holiday travellers share, drinker clock starts when you arrive at the airport. Loads of people do it. Now, I understand your concern. By the way, I massively admire you. I think drink isn't really the proudest thing that our particular culture does. So credit to you for not drinking. It probably takes away more than it gives most people. But I don't think that we should be prescribing. And here's why. For a lot of people, it's downtime. They're living in broken Britain. We're not talking politics, I know, but they're fed up. So they get there perhaps at 5 or 6 in the morning. And it's part of one of those rituals, which might not once again be the finest ritual, but it's so patronizing of O'Leary, the guy in charge of Ryanair, to say, oh, you can't have more than 2 drinks, leaving aside the complete unenforceability of it, incidentally.
I just think
that it just means that he can't run an airline where his passengers are under control. I don't tend to see people out of control on the airlines that I fly with, and it doesn't tend to be Ryanair, I have to say. So it's more of a reflection of the fact that he is perhaps not able to have ruly passengers on his plane. Don't take it out on everybody else.
Emma?
The thing is, they sort of... I kind of agree with you. Michael O'Leary is definitely a bit patronising in general and quite one of those annoying people you can rely on to come out with annoying pronouncements while making his billions. But the thing is, they have to deal with the fallout. And, you know, you're right, Lambert. Most flights are full of respectful, safe people, but it is a very confined space, especially on those budget airlines. You can barely even fit in your seat. When you do get unlucky, and when you are on a flight with a bunch of very, very drunken, rowdy stag people going to Estonia or wherever, it's not much fun. And it is the airlines that have to then deal with that, and the airline staff, and that cannot be a fun job. And many years ago, in my 20s, I was on a flight where people were being sick in the tiny bathrooms and things like that. It does make you think, is this really the safest place for people to go and down 10 pints and then get on a flight?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm Estonian. How dare you racially stereotype people going to Estonia? You'll be hearing from my lawyer for that.
Sorry, Lem, I thought you said you were an Estonian. You're an Estonian Estonian. Yes.
Apart from my late brother, I'm the only other Estonian Estonian, but that's another story. But I am both of those things. But you would never possibly have Estonians for the uninitiated. The finest school in the north of Ireland, I'd say. But you never have them behaving like this. But the thing is, it doesn't just take alcohol to make people misbehave. I saw this German couple, and the man was screaming. He was obviously sober, screaming at the security, accusing them of this and that. And he goes, "What is your name?" To which somebody in the queue shouted, "Don't tell him, Pike," which was amusing. But the fact was, he wasn't rude because he was drunk. So where do you draw the line? Now, I understand, for example, why smoking's not allowed on planes, because if you go to an aircraft museum, 40 years after those planes were decommissioned, they still smell of alcohol, of cigarettes.
Really?
Alcohol's different, yeah. I mean, it's if you go up to a museum, you can smell the deeply ingrained smoke. And that's different. But when it comes to alcohol, as we both agree, or maybe all three of us agree, very small number of people get out of hand. But here's the question. If O'Leary gets his way, 2 drinks in the airport, How are you going to stop people getting drunk before they get there? They will do it. What does it call? Preloading. They'll preload before they get to the airport. So it's completely unenforceable. But my fundamental point is 99% of people who fly, even on Ryanair, tend to be fairly sensible. Maybe it's 95%. But are we going to punish that 95% because between 1% and 5% can't control themselves? O'Leary, you get your act together because other airlines seem to have done it.
Emma, is one of the issues here the fact that certainly in recent years there have been a lot more delays and you're actually helping passengers by providing a bar service in moderation? And as Lambert says, most people can regulate themselves, can't they?
Well, and as I said, you know, most people are not going to be antisocial or unruly or violent or any of that. But it is the airline staff who have to deal with it.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you about airports. They've almost done the net zero job for them by making flying and making travelling such an unpleasant experience. Honestly, I have definitely cut down on trips abroad because I know that I cannot cope with the idea of waiting with a small child waiting in an airport for 10 hours on the, you know, sitting on the floor waiting and waiting for flights to be cancelled and then rescheduled and no information, all of that. So they've made, whoever's done it has done a brilliant job of making airports and flying a horrible, horrible, stressful experience.
It's not stressful and horrible.
You need drink to get through that, I'll tell you. I would absolutely be at the front of the queue for whatever they're handing out, you know, when you get just delayed like that.
Here's the thing. I have at times in my life been a frequent flyer because I was traveling on business. I had a global role with a big company. And then I was able to go to the lounges, the executive lounges. Though I have to say British Airways for another time has completely ruined the proposition now. But there's free in those lounges. I never, literally never saw anyone out of hand in those lounges, even though it was free booze. So it does show that a lot of the most frequent flyers, they do know how to behave. They don't get drunk before the flight, and they tend not to get drunk on the flight. Now, I do agree with you. If you're in cattle class and you're going through the airport and the weather's foggy or something, it can be abysmal, especially with children. I've experienced that. But it doesn't take away from the fact that we have to be responsible for ourselves.
And of social stereotyping going on there.
Well, you started it by talking about Estonia.
So, but the posh rich people in the business lounge can manage their alcohol and just have a nice sip of champagne, whereas the rest of them in cattle class are downing pints in the dirty pubs and bars. I mean, the whole thing is a nightmare, really. Why can't they just get the planes flying? If they got us to wherever we needed to be, there wouldn't be time for all this excess loading and pre-drinking and all of that. If O'Leary concentrated on doing his job, getting the flights off the ground quickly, things might be a little bit less boozy.
Okay, why doesn't he just get rid of the toilets? He can put more seats on.
Steady.
And although you might get drunk the first time, you'll certainly learn your lesson for the second.
Steady, there was a story that broke yesterday about a passenger who was afraid of flying and ended up drinking too much and they actually urinated in the middle of the aisle. Can you imagine?
Yeah, well, Gerard Depardieu.
Can you
imagine the person who had to clean that? It's absolutely abysmal, isn't it?
But anyway, the final point to you both is, and Lambert, I'm on Emma's side there whenever you were socially stereotyping a lot of people. Are the people more likely to have one too many, not the kind of hard-working people for whom a flight is an absolute novelty? And maybe like Emma, they've had a young child, they've been up night after night after night, suddenly they've got somebody to mind their young one, and they've got a bit of freedom, and they just can't help themselves, Lambert.
Well, first of all, in terms of the business class lounges, I'm just telling you it's an empirical fact. That's what I've seen. Whether it's stereotyping or not, I'm just telling you my observation. Now, the second point, the interesting question you ask, I do think, and to this extent I'll compromise on what I've said, I do think that people who think it's all about getting drunk for 2 weeks are more likely to do it, and it can be a real pain if you've got an elderly person like my late disabled mother or children.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to see my children to be exposed to thinking that's acceptable behaviour. I agree with that. But the problem doesn't really lie with flying. And honestly, neither of you have really explained how you possibly we could enforce it. It's a mindset. And it's just about being responsible when you're in a confined space, because you could say exactly the same for trains and buses and waiting rooms and a lot of other places. I went, my friend of mine was in the hospital on a Friday night, and I went into the waiting room, and it was just like the retreat from Moscow. It was just a nightmare because the whole place was full of drunks. So the problem isn't really about flying. It's something in our culture. When I go to a place to Sofia in Bulgaria, you don't see this kind of behavior. And you don't tend to see it with the locals in places like Greece. Hmm. We export our bad behavior, and while O'Leary's out of order, trying to stop people from drinking, I think, we're probably out of order as a society.
Lambert, thank you. Emma, thank you as well. That's Lambert Opick and Emma Wolfe. We're moving on quickly, and a real change of tone here, because we want to get the latest before we go about these encouraging signals that are coming out of the Middle East about a possible ceasefire in Gaza. I know a lot of people have been texting this programme, trying to get on this programme, outlining their concerns over the last 15 months about what's been going on. It looks as if there's a possible ceasefire in the wind. Let's get the very latest from the former BBC Middle East correspondent, Jim Muir. Good morning, Jim. Bring us right up to date. Good.
Well, there's, to be honest, nothing terribly new to say. These talks are going on very intensively in Qatar, in the Gulf, of course, with Americans there, Israelis there, Egyptians, and, of course, Hamas itself, all banging their heads trying to finalize the basic details that have been snagging things for the last few days. According to the Qataris, who are the main mediators, the broad lines have been agreed that the main points of divergence have been sorted out, but there's a lot of details, and as we all know, for any agreement, the devil is in the detail, and nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So they're haggling over things like exactly which prisoners would be released by Israel, Palestinian prisoners, that is, exactly which hostages would be released by Hamas in a first stage, and there's lots of little details there as well about also what exactly Israel would do by way of primary withdrawals, you know, starting to withdraw from Gaza, what would be the sequencing of all these events and so on. So there's lots of ways in which it could still get snagged. Hamas says, for example, it's waiting for a map, for maps from Israel of exactly what withdrawals they would take in the first phase of a three-phase agreement, which would ultimately, hopefully at least in phase three, lead to the kind of a total peace and reconstruction of Gaza.
Jim, as we know from our own experience here in Belfast, a deadline sometimes helps. And we have change coming at the White House. That's a double-edged sword, though. I mean, is it more likely if there is going to be a deal, it's going to be on Biden's watch or Trump's watch?
Well, it could be almost on the kind of watershed between the two. There's no doubt at all that President, or about to be re-president, as it were,
yes,
Trump, his return to the White House on Monday is very definitely the date towards which all these talks are now heading. We could have had this agreement months ago when President Biden announced the basic lines of this agreement back in May of last year, and that was supposedly based on an Israeli proposal, but it just got snagged again and again and again. And now here it is again with the final details being ironed out. But it is very much going to be pegged to that date, Monday. What's encouraging, I think, is that President Trump's Middle East, or about to be future President Trump's Middle East envoy, has been involved in these talks. So President Biden is taking care to ensure that what he passes on to the new White House on Monday will be something that is not going to be sort of shot down by the Trump administration as a product of the Biden administration. They're going to have a stake in it, and that's very, very important. And I think that's another reason why these things are moving on in a way that does look very hopeful. I mean, for the first time, I think I can say I'd be surprised if it doesn't happen. In the past, I've been saying in similar interviews over the last 15 months that I'd be surprised if it did happen.
So you've changed your mind, Jim. You think it's more likely than not now?
Oh, yes, I definitely think it's more likely than not. If it doesn't happen now, as Trump has said, there'll be hell to pay. And he's made it clear through his envoy that that applies to the Israelis as well as to Hamas. He's not saying we're going to bring our bombers out and pulverize Gaza and kill every Hamas member. He's warned the Israelis that they will also be in trouble if they don't do it. So there is a general scramble to get it done before he takes office.
Jim, thanks as always. That's the former BBC Middle East correspondent, Jim Muir. And there's a lot more on this on the BBC News website. And Jim hinted at it there. There is a lot of detail out there about a three-stage process that is being worked on. A lot of detail in there. It is very, very interesting. You'll see it on the front page of the BBC News website. Matters closer to home before we go. We're going to just talk about the Boyne Bridge. Robert, the taxi driver, has phoned in. Robert, what do you think?
Well, Mark, nobody has touched on this. The planners of the new Grand Central Station closed the Boyne Bridge without planning permission, costing hundreds of pounds lost revenue to taxi drivers. Somebody said, why taxi drivers? Because the lost revenue over the Christmas period and the build-up towards Christmas, taxi drivers lost all that revenue because you know why? North, south, east and west of Belfast City, they all went to, people went to the shopping centres and the shopped online in bulk. And as a result of that Boyne Bridge and the whole build-up months before it, it put people off getting into the city and we lost hundreds of pounds on lost revenue. My point here is, Mark, who's going to compensate us and other businesses? Yeah, hear me out. Who's going to compensate taxi drivers and lost up hundreds of pounds and all their businesses? Who's going to compensate? Is it going to be the organisers who close that Boyne Bridge without planning permission?
Well, to be clear, as far as we can understand, and there isn't an awful lot of transparency at the moment coming from the department or TransLink, but our understanding is that TransLink went into this believing they had planning permission, and we've seen some evidence that they were told even in the middle of last month that things were okay. Something has gone wrong. It may just be, in the grand scheme of things, a minor issue, but Mark, you're saying, Robert, sorry, you going ahead.
Yeah, I would like to say, believing and factual are two different things. I believe they have a lottery ticket here and have the winning numbers on it. But when I look carefully at it, I haven't got the winning numbers.
Robert, help us. What's traffic been like since Christmas in the city?
Well, Mark, look, call a spade a spade. Everybody knows, everybody truthfully knows that the busiest time of the year is December for the economy. Mm-hmm. January, when people get back to work in January, everything wanes down. Mm-hmm. There is Patrick is right. That is a bottleneck at Great Victoria Street. That's not going away anytime soon. And it relates to going back to the Boyne Bridge again. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing problem. You go down Great Victoria Street to turn left.
Go on, Robert.
Turn left and the, you know,
push it out of your mouth. Things are a bit better than they were before Christmas. Push it out.
It's not better for taxis, because taxis are sitting an hour, an hour and 45 minutes.
I wanted to end on a positive note. But listen, thanks. Oh, yes, now you're talking. Thanks for phoning in. Thanks for everybody's listening. I know some people are listening in hospital today. We're thinking of you. Connor Phillips, you love him too. He's next.
Show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.